Expanding Mind with Eric Davis and Maja Daoust, Thursdays at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome, folks, to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, and today, further explorations of the cultures of consciousness into psychedelic adolescence and the possibilities of spiritual tripping. Today, I'm really happy to have our guest, Peter Bebergal. I hope I'm pronouncing that right, Bebergal. His book, Too Much to Dream. It's funny. I sort of exchanged emails with Peter and tweets and such, and I just had a sense of a certain kind of resonance, you know. And there's a weird feeling you have when you're a writer and you think about certain zones of your life, things you want to write about, and then you read other people who kind of got it, and it's this weird sense of kind of recognition and almost relief that somebody else did it. And while his story in his book, Too Much to Dream, A Psychedelic American Boyhood, it's definitely different than mine in a lot of ways, there's a really interesting resonance. And I was already, he's about my age, early 40s. He grew up in the East Coast. I grew up on the West Coast. But we had a similar kind of attraction to weird comic books, subcultures, occult records, marijuana, other compounds, and all bound up in a certain desire to kind of have magical experience, this kind of sense of the possibility that there was sort of another world just around the corner. And so I'm reading, I'm finally getting to read this book on the plane. I'm sitting there, and he's talking about, Rush albums and D&D and Led Zeppelin and Smoking Bowls. And I'm all like, oh, my God, it's like, this is really, like, it's really working for me. It's really similar here. And then the most spooky synchronicity that I just have to report. Since, for years now, I have been trying to remember a single short comic book piece that was in an issue of Eerie magazine that I saw when I was in the early 70s. And the end of this story, which is about this kid getting magical power and revenging the death of this cool guy by these evil mobsters, the final image of this Richard Corbin image of this demon playing a cosmic hellish pinball game with the poor soul of this mobster bouncing around. And I couldn't find it. I didn't remember who wrote it. I didn't remember what issue it was. And there I am, and he talks specifically about this piece. And then on the next page, he mentions my book. So it totally blew my mind. Clearly we have some kind of secret link, so I'm really happy to talk to Peter today. I'm sure it's going to be a great show. And but first, of course, we'll bring on our co-host here in Expanding Mind, Maja Daou. Hi, Maja.
Hi, Eric. How are you?
Pretty good. Now, I know you're kind of a D&D kind of girl, but there weren't a lot of D&D girls. So, I mean, what happened? Well, you must have heard about D&D when you were a kid and gone, that sounds kind of fun, but I don't know about that.
I went pretty full on into D&D. What clinched it for me were the monster manuals. I got one look at the monster manuals, and that was it. I was, like, drawing the displacer beasts and the beholders and, like, all those things. And then my sisters and I asked my mom for I remember it very clearly, the Advanced Dungeons & Dragons set. It was the red one with the dragon on the cover. And my sisters and I got a hold of that set, and that was it. We just played with each other. It was the three of us. There weren't any other, like, chicks that were down with it. So we just did it by ourselves, and that was, like, our little sisterhood of the Dungeons & Dragons.
That's awesome, man. I've never heard that. I wonder how many little pods, little kind of hidden fem pods of D&D playing there are out there. That's
we kept it to ourselves so no one would make fun of us, but we secretly enjoyed every minute of it.
did you like drink Coca-Cola and stay up all night and eat chips and stuff? Or?
Oh yeah, pretty much. Yeah.
That's one. Somehow I'm not surprised. So. Well, great. I think we're all going to be in some consonants here, so I'll bring Peter on. Peter, welcome to Expanding Mind.
Hey, Eric. Thanks so much for having me.
So how do you pronounce your last name?
Biebergall.
Biebergall. Great. Yeah. Great. Yeah, so really, first off, I just got to thank you for like finally getting that reference for that that piece. It's been haunting me literally for years, and I was just really pleased and shocked to see it in there.
I spent so much time with creepy and airy magazines, and I don't think any story ever impacted me as much as that pinball story.
No, it's come back again and again. It's a really funny one. So, again, I just got to say, you did a remarkable job of capturing a kind of a time period, a set of cultural impulses, the spiritual hedonistic desires, the confusions of adolescence, you know, from my perspective, you really got something that I realize in some ways is kind of specific to our generation. I mean, there are always these things that are specific to generations. But also one that I think is really, it also, resonates, further than that. So I'm kind of curious, did you just sort of want to capture, you obviously were trying to write about your own experience and how you kind of got into drugs and then how devastating drugs became for you, and then you're wrestling with, what's good there, what's valuable, how can you still have access to the good stuff even though you've been committed to sobriety for a while. But it also seemed like you were telling like a cultural story, like a story of a certain time, a certain relationship to comic books and movies and records and, a certain kind of more like a cultural critic. So it's this really interesting mixture of cultural reflection and cultural storytelling and a very personal tale. How are those things kind of woven together for you?
Well, I think as I went back to decide, to decide that I was going to tell this story, I immediately realized that no human experience happens in a vacuum, right? That we are absolutely bound by our cultural moment, whatever that is. And I think it's very hard to transcend that. I think we often want our own experiences to somehow be so precious that they transcend, our cultural, our religious, our language, whatever it is, and to sort of really have to be honest with myself about how much not only did I grow up in a particular time that really shaped the kind of person that I was going to be, but it also shaped the expectations that I had about what drugs, what the occult, what spiritual experiences were going to be for me. And when I realized that there was no way I was going to have a pure experience, and I don't think anybody can really, that's another thing we can talk about, whether or not there's such a thing as a pure experience, but I realized that I had to sort of do sort of an archaeology and an anthropology of that time to better not only understand myself, but to understand how powerful of a moment that in particular was, like you said, very specific, I think, to our generation, to have really been at the front line of some kind of very weird spiritual moment, particularly in America.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I think in a way, like my experience of it just is like totally proof of your argument. And I think maybe as like a younger person, I would have read this book and it would have irritated me because I would have been like, he's talking about my experience, man.
Right.
But now I'm older, it's the opposite. It's like, oh my God, yeah, that's, you actually you plugged into that sort of mindset and that framework. And I'm just thinking of one other element that's actually a little bit less cultural, although I want to come back to the comic books and the movies and In Search Of and all that kind of stuff, but this is just popping into my head. I wrote a kind of very short, not dissimilar piece about being a pothead in high school for the Village Voice way back in the early 90s, and it was one of the pieces I got the most interesting feedback from and one of the pieces I'm proudest of, because I was trying to do something really similar to you, is to sort of account for the kind of influences of the culture, of the weird kind of spiritual ambience that was mixed up with, you know, books and comics and records and weirdos that we would meet.
Right.
And one of the things that I wrote in that piece that that came back to me in a way that I remembered when I read your book was there was one part about how I talked about how pot, for especially for kids, kind of leads them into nature or whatever kind of nature they have available, because just, you know, literally you have to kind of sneak off in order to, you know, smoke or whatever. But what that ends up doing is this really positive thing where it leads kids to, like, finding those areas of their landscapes, even if they're growing up in the suburbs or in the cities,
absolutely,
where there's some kind of organic, kind of crumbly, you know, it's an underpass, it's a little
right,
part of a park. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I had two things like that. I had right behind my house was a plot that they had started building some condominium association that something happened, somebody went bankrupt, and there was the foundation and like three or four walls, and then this overgrown brush and weeds and tree stumps, and it was absolutely magical to me. I was convinced that this place was like the source of some seat of ancient power, you know, and I needed something like that so badly. Being in the suburbs, growing up in that environment, and looking for something that sort of was a borderland, you know,
exactly,
between those two
borderland
places. Yeah, and then the other one, which I talk about quite a bit in the book, is this golf course. And there was a golf course I basically live with right near strip mall. But behind the supermarkets and the delicatessens, there was this immense private golf course that attached itself to this small wooded area. And so we used to spend a lot of time partying on this golf course, and I would always find myself wandering off into sort of the denser part of the wooded areas. And again, convinced, and whether convinced or just desperate to find something where I felt like I was connected to, like you're talking about, this organic sense. And so so it was an authentic. There was something more authentic about the organic, right? Something more authentic about a natural space.
I think it's might even more than that. Here, let's riff a little bit, is that what those places are like, because they're sort of crumbly and sort of they're not entirely integrated into,
right,
you know, human maps. So there are borderlands. So what does that mean is that certain kinds of imaginations, particularly when they're amplified by cannabis, but also comic books and D&D and all that, for a certain kind of imagination, it's easier to kind of project that possible world because it's not so organized. It's kind of a mixture. It's sort of ambiguous, like what it is. So you can kind of project yourself. And that came through really, really strongly. And I remembered a lot of the similar kind of impressions when I was, you know, 13, 14, 15 years old, when these sort of places that if I looked at them now would just be some kind of grubby rock under this, like, withered tree, whatever. And at the
right
time, they were like seats of power. This was where metaphorically, where the gnomes lived. I mean, I didn't believe
exactly
the gnomes lived there, but
right,
it felt like gnomes lived there.
Exactly. And don't you still feel that? I mean, I feel my wife lives out grew up in Western Mass, and we often drive out there to visit her family. And, you know, along the way, there's roads or there's homes where there is the stone, the edge of a stone wall, and in a wooded area where maybe there had been a farm or something. And there's still that leftover bit of the stone wall. And whenever I see that, I get that feeling again like I had when I was that stone kid on the golf course, you know, that there's
absolutely
something strange and magical and mysterious about, again, that borderland, that intersection, you know.
Well, it's interesting, too. I mean, I grew up in total nature land, like in the forest and on an island, and like how many people that are raised in a strictly city environment actually get interested in, like, magic and the occult. And, I mean, I'm not, like, I haven't done any kind of research on it, but I have never met anyone that grew up in a, like, complete, like, city-fied without those little, like, borderlands that actually did become interested in this. Or if they did, it was much later on in life. I think having those spaces is so crucial to kind of, like, be able to become aware of any of this stuff. I mean, I don't know. In your experience, have you, like, run into, like, super city peeps that get into this stuff?
Well, I mean, now as I'm older, it seems a little bit less and less as people are busy, you know, shuffling their kids off to after-school programs and things, so it's harder to get people to admit to talk about these things. But when we sort of reflect on our childhood, especially, you know, like my wife and things like that, there's definitely this thing about, you know, particularly when you're partying, like not wanting to be at the mall, right?
Mm.
Trying to find some place that can speak to whatever that little bit of weirdness that you know is going to erupt at any moment, you know, and having to find a location for it.
Well,
yeah, that's the thing. I think that people, and that was one of the things that I, when people read my story, even though I was writing about growing up in a suburban area where there were like canyons and sort of, you know, unmarked, relatively unmarked places that were quote unquote nature, is that I talked to a lot of people who were from cities, who grew up in New York or whatever, and they go, yeah, totally. That was the same thing for me. There was that vacant lot. There was that weird, you know, abandoned building. There was that part of the park where people can. So I think it's more like in your head. It's not so much like you look at it literally. It's that you suddenly see the world in a different way. You're like, oh wait, there's a culvert that we can smoke out in, therefore it's kind of a borderland, you know, so it's it's available everywhere.
You know, my son plays this game right now. I have a 10-year-old son called Minecraft. Have you heard of this game?
No.
It's called a sandbox game. It's looks like an old 8-bit game. Basically you start off with nothing but your hand, and you have to dig dirt, and then you have to chop down a tree, and then you have to build an axe, and you can chop down more trees, and you have to build a little crafting table, and then you have to mine, and you get better and better tools and better resources, and you build little houses and things, and it's pretty brilliant because you actually have to craft the next level of materials that you need. And one of the things it's so amazing to me when you think about this, one of the developers of the game added this little Easter egg in the game, which is that if you mine a particular kind of stone, obsidian, you can build what's called an obsidian gate. Okay, so you're in this world. It's just like a sort of a normal natural environment where you're building urban sort of landscapes. And then you can build this obsidian gate, and if you spark fire into it, you can walk through the gate and become in this place called the Netherlands, right? So why would they add that to this game? Like, what is it about that desire that even when you're, they know who their audience is, you know, it's kids constructing, you know, sort of Lego on their computer, you know, building these worlds, and they get a sense that there's going to be that group of kids that are going to want to know if there's some mysterious portal to another dimension. And they're not going to make it easy for you, but if you're going to be the kind of kid that's going to go looking for that, they're going to give you a little puzzle to solve to figure out how to do that.
You know, that makes me really happy because it also reminds me that there is a kind of continuity. Sometimes I look at popular culture today and I worry about whether the portals are still being sort of set up with the proper kind of evocative quality, even though there is a lot of magic and video games, et cetera, et cetera. But that's particularly ingenious. I mean, partly because, like, if you just invoke magic, which I know is a lot of your own influence as well, reading about magic and reading magical tomes and all that, is that, you know, the obsidian mirror, that's what John Dee's showstone was made out of. It was made out of obsidian. So it's a pretty interesting. So that makes me think, like, the guy, whoever did that, wasn't just interested in sort of a generic, you know, D&D thing. They actually kind of knew something, you know, and you know, how that kind of lore continues and impacts that stuff. That's great. But here's a question I have from you. You know, we've talked, so now we've kind of established this sort of, you know, these kinds of magical desires that are particularly strong, I think, in in adolescence. It's like, and it makes sense in a way, you know, you're moving out of this period where, you know, you still live in kind of a mythological world. You know, a lot of kids get into mythology when they're 10 years old, 11 years old. You know, you're still kind of in your imaginal world. You haven't quite realized how dull and constraining and mundane the world can be, and then you suddenly start to see that, and you're like, oh boy, here we go. Gotta make sure I still have a portal. And one of the things that happens is you turn to comic books and records and all that kind of stuff. And another thing is you turn to drugs. So, one of the things you're meditating on in a very complex way in your book that's hard to, and I don't really even feel like you necessarily kind of come to an answer with it, you're still wrestling, is how part of the desire or the attraction to some drugs, to pot and psychedelics particularly, are come out of this deeper, really authentic need for magic, and how those things get kind of confused and amplified. I mean, how did you end up kind of figuring your way through all of those issues when it came to writing your own story?
Well, part of it is that cultural moment, right? So that the those things that I was interested in, those comic books, those records, drugs were a subtext. And it was very difficult, I think, to not see that, especially I had older siblings, and they made drugs a subtext in their own way, you know? And you know, the kinds of things that were on television always made drugs a subtext, even while they were trying to steer the youth away from drugs, right? All they were doing was making it a subtext to everything, to sexual feelings, to all the ways in which they tried to demonize everything at the same time, right? So drugs were bad, Dungeons and Dragons were bad, sex was bad, comic books are bad, so all these things are bad, and they all seem to fit sort of in a schema together. And as I began to explore these things, there was always a part that was stopping short. I knew, as much as things like comic books and playing D&D opened me up to starting to think about an idea of something beyond my own, you know, beyond the mundane, beyond the mainstream, that intuitively I understood that they were only going to get me so far. The next thing was music. That always felt like that was the next place to go, that you were going to get somewhere a little bit further, that particularly, you know, rock and roll at that time was able to evoke a certain kind of feeling in me that I'm even embarrassed about when I think about, like, how much the Styx record evoked that feeling, you know, when I was 11 years old. But it did. It really did. Like, listening to that stuff really evoked that in a way that was, like, the next level after playing D&D, a little bit deeper. It brought me a little bit deeper, you know. And then, again, because sex and drugs is the thing that seemed to be fueling that in its own way, it only made sense, I think, for the kind of kid that I was going to have to explore that ultimately for good or ill, and sadly for me a lot of it was ill, but and so those things sort of came together. But that confusion was that because I had massaged my consciousness and my unconscious with so many of these images and so many of these ideas that came from everything from, like, Silver Surfer comics to, I'm so glad that, you know, Monster Manuals were mentioned, you know, because that was the thing that drove my whole love of D&D too, with the Monster Manuals. All the ways in which those shaped what my ideas about what a spiritual or magical experience was going to be, that when I actually started on my of initiation into drug use, that was the language that I brought to it. You know, that was the code that I brought to those experiences. And one of the questions I have is, one, you know, did I then dilute what could have been a more pure experience by having it have been so shaped by these cultural artifacts? Or is it necessarily that all experiences like that are going to be shaped in some way by these cultural artifacts?
Then I think you can find that out. But I mean, I know you, like, studied comparative religion, and so have you talked to, like, monks or priests and asked them, like, what brought them to, like, religion?
Well, I mean, I know lots of stories of how people sort of get there, but those from, if you read those or talk to those people, they're again always shaped by some culturally contained experience, even though we all want to say that on the other side of that is maybe a pure transcendent idea that we're all moving towards, but language is the method by which we talk about those things, and so there's no way to get past the language of it.
Because a lot of people, like in my experience that I've talked to, that get to those places, it's usually something kind of messed up that takes them there. I mean, it's usually literally a crisis.
Right, right. So that's the great spiritual axiom, though, right, that you have to descend. You have to hit
right.
some kind of bottom. You have to go into Hades. You have
yeah.
to, right, that you're transformed, and then you come out the other side towards this more pure thing.
I don't see any impurity in the below either. That's everyone puts the judgment on it, like with Dungeons and Dragons and Alice Cooper
right.
or, you know, Ozzy Osbourne, that's like satanic, so Satan equals bad. But the reality, as you said, was the best way to get to heaven is to go into a cave. So I don't understand
right.
why
well,
that's
guess,
impure.
Well, I guess I don't mean impure in a sense of not being holy. I think what I'm saying when I use the word pure is more between mediated or unmediated.
Mm.
Right? Okay, so
right,
maybe
yeah.
That's a better word. Okay, so all my experiences were mediated by
mm.
the cultural language that I had, you know, dove so deeply into.
So unmediated would mean you found it exclusively on your own.
Or that the experience itself doesn't include any of that baggage, right?
Right. So that's the idea that, like, even, you know, someone sitting on their meditation pillow and then they have this, like, tremendous experience of pure consciousness, that if you actually kind of look at it, you're like, well, what it was is they've, you know, anticipated some experience like pure consciousness, and their Zen teacher told them about that, and they read these books, and so they were already kind of set up, like almost pre-programmed, so that when some kind of opening happens, they are ready there with the script, you know, and so,
right.
and
or
this
even,
is a classic,
yeah.
you know, such a big problem in, you know, comparative religion and whatever, and, you know, there's lots of ways to think about it, Before we kind of get that, I want to get a little more into your story, which it isn't just this question of whether or not your experiences or your drive was mediated and maybe mediated in an unhealthy way, but it was also the way that your quest, your legitimate spiritual quest, if we call it that, for, you know, and maybe your idea of it was not great at that time, that you thought it was some kind of magical enchantment or some kind of ulterior, but that motivation was very, very sweet and honest, and yet it drives you into this really complicated place where it gets involved with substance abuse and abusive substances that aren't particularly enchanting and don't necessarily have that opening. And so one of the real kind of complexities of your book that I've been kind of sitting with is just that how to extricate that, you know, how to say, well, this was the legitimate spiritual impulse or move towards enchantment or towards depth, and yet it took me so far down on some level where I bottomed out, or and then what? Is it still legitimate? Do you not, you know, were they actually illegitimate in retrospect, and that life is just what it is, and the search for magic is ridiculous, and it gets you in trouble, or no, there's something there, but your koan, it's like your conundrum, your cross in that sense is to be noticing both sides, that there is this legitimate thing, and yet it can really, and
right.
in your case, really took you in a place that wasn't just like a dark night of the soul, it was like you could die or really hurt somebody. I mean, it was a bad thing.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's absolutely legitimate. And I have to say, you know, for the record, like, I do believe in some kind of transcendence. I mean, the problem is I think that we always have to use language to describe it. And so we have to be very careful about language and about then thinking that language is what we literally, that we're saying something literal about it, right? But I do believe that it's absolutely authentic and real. I think temperament has a lot to do with it. I also think that the nature of addiction is itself, you know, what Carl Jung had talked about, that he commented to Bill Wilson after Bill Wilson after Alcoholics Anonymous became very successful, he wrote to Carl Jung and said, wanted to thank him because there were some connections. Actually, one of Jung's patients made their way through the long and sordid history of Alcoholics Anonymous and was actually a primary person involved in that and in getting Bill Wilson to get sober. But he thanked Jung for sort of having the forethought to understand sort of the spiritual side of this. And Jung had said that he didn't think it was a coincidence that the word for the Latin for alcohol is spiritus, right? That there's something essential about that desire for drink or drug that is intimately tied into that desire for a spiritual experience.
Well, it's interesting, too, though, because if you look at the etymology of alcohol, it actually comes from al-ghul, which is like a ghoul is in a dead thing, and that's actually like what Medusa is named after, too. And it comes from the like cremation sites in India that the tantricas used to use, and it was that the alcohol was like a traditionally spiritual thing to use to lift the spirit away from the ghouls, from the demons.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it's if you look at al-ghul and alcohol, it's totally nuts.
That's amazing. I've never heard that.
Well, on that marvelous, fabulous etymology, I got to introduce a brief break here. We're talking to Peter Bibergall on Expanding Mind, and we'll be right back after these messages.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm Maja Daou, and we're here with Eric Davis. We're speaking with Peter Bibergall, and we're talking about drugs and D&D and God and stuff. And before the break, we had mentioned a little bit, and we're talking about, you know, some of these mediators and facilitators and kind of how alcohol can be one of those to raise your spirits. I always say spirits to raise the spirits whenever I'd take a drink. But in your experience, I mean, you had talked a little bit about how your past and your cultural experiences kind of led you into some of, you know, your mystic experiences. And how, I know you spent time on the East Coast and at Harvard. How were you received among those kind of circles? Did people take you any less seriously because of your D&D history, or do you find that you can chit-chat with them and they're pretty cool about it?
Yeah, I mean, I ended up, eventually I went back to school and I ended up at Harvard Divinity School, and that was a place where a lot of freaks end up kind of, you know, congregating. So there was a lot of like-minded, there was actually people that considered themselves practicing magicians that
really?
Were there. Yeah, I mean, it was few, you know, but there were some Wiccans. There were still lots of Episcopalians and, you know, everybody else and many, many Unitarians, but, you know, it was really a place where people felt, because it was, you know, seen as sort of an academic study of religion, and I think that it gave people an opportunity to explore a wide-ranging idea about what the religious experience is. And so there was a lot of opportunity to meet a lot of different kinds of people, and so I think in that regard I sort of fit right in, being somebody who came from sort of a non-traditional background. So it ended up being a really good place. Now, I didn't interact much with Harvard University per se, but, you know, Harvard Divinity School in its own way sort of attracted people, I think, from slightly, there was enough of people who felt themselves on the fringe of things that it definitely felt like home.
Right. Well, and because this is something I run up against quite a bit, is a lot of people who, they will, you know, view the fringe as something that is evil or satanic. I've certainly been accused of being Satanist. But at the same time, they're having the exact same experiences that maybe you might describe, or that is the mystic experience. And so I'm always curious when folks are, you know, talking about those kind of experiences they've had, like how they get reception from folks that are a little more institutional or maybe dogmatic about it. But do you just kind of steer clear of those kind of people and not have many interactions with them?
Well, yeah. So, I mean, there's definitely, it goes to the whole question of whether or not your beliefs are going to come across as literal or as fundamentalist in that way, that you can't, that you're not open to the idea that you know, one mountain, many paths, or many mountains and one path, or, you know, depending
right.
on what you're thinking about. But I think that one of the things that I came to terms with was really trying to understand for myself in studying religion in that way, was trying to get to an understanding between the differences between magic and mysticism. And that was a mistake that I think that I don't want to call it a mistake because I'm making a judgment about it, but for myself, I had confused those things when I was having my sort of my deeper questing with all this stuff.
What do you think now is the difference between magic and mysticism?
Well, I think what I've discovered is a confusion for myself, I should say, around seeking knowledge of the divine will or seeking to effect change on the divine will. In that sense. So one is about sort of drawing down, and the other is about, I don't want to say it imposition, again, I don't mean to use it in a negative way, but I think that it's about a relationship to the divine that is different. One is more oriented towards your own will, and one is more oriented towards the divine will. The Kabbalist and artist David Chaim Smith, do you know his work? Are you familiar with him?
No,
So he talks about how the authentic mystical experience is different from the magical experience in that it has devotion. It has an aspect of devotion to God or to the divine. And so that's one way in which you can find whether or not that experience is magical or whether or not it's mystical. In that sense, it's obviously very subtle, and again, I'm using words that maybe probably don't convey the actual experiences that people have, but.
Yeah, it's definitely one of those situations where you're going to have different takes on the material. You know, I think another way of thinking about that in a somewhat slightly different register, but still acknowledging that the difference is that the world of magic or of the occult is often a very rich world of images and correspondences and,
right.
and sets of relationships and lore and practices and, you know, especially the links between things. And that as you sort of, like, you know, climb up that ladder, and I'm using a, you know, hierarchical metaphor, as you kind of move through things, they become, for many, not always, more simple or more sort of unified, and that there's a kind of ultimate transparency that has to do with being able to finally rest, to like be able to like simply receive, or to, you know, simply be in what the situation is, which is, you know, very different than, you know, drawing a sigil and calling up some spirit at the right astrological moment and using the right kind of herb or, you know, whatever, which is just, you know, one kind of magic. But the reason I bring that up is that I think it partly has to do with the whole conversation we had before about culture and about what you're absorbing and what you're taking in, because for our generation, you know, just ordinary pop culture, the sort of, you know, leavings of the counterculture that we were just sort of just behind as they kind of went through their psychedelic and then spiritual search, and then there's all this kind of material that was produced by the popular culture industries and television and all this stuff, and we were just kind of, you know, feeding on these things, that they almost inevitably gave this kind of occult charge to things, because it was just, you, just by absorbing this cultural material with a certain kind of desire, you started to build your own system of magical correspondences where,
absolutely.
You know, that one Led Zeppelin record was kind of like that one D&D thing, was like that one time I smoked pot and I saw this vision and this mushroom that was talking, and that, you know, you kind of enter into this network of correspondences. So whether or not you are like forcing your will on things or receiving things passively, it's like you're in this occult zone that you're like, oh my god, this is like, you know, whoa, this is just like what's real. And I remember very distinctly believe, you know, again, a real similar sense of what was kind of real and not real there. And at the end of your book, you start talking about, you know, you have a kind of extended, you know, it's sort of a different phase of the book where you're really going into this question of the relationship of psychedelics to, you know, kind of authentic mystical experience and authentic spirituality. And I wanted to make sure that we get into that, as well as, you know, kind of tipping our hats to this magical universe that can be so tricksy, that can initiate us, yeah, but can also trip us up.
To end that part, or at least to sort of wrap, one thing I wanted to say about that is I was really fascinated with the conversation that you had with Dr. Wolfson about dreams. And I wanted to tell you about a dream that I had that I feel like is very, really helps understand that confusion, the confusion that I made. This was when I was in graduate school. It's probably the best dream I ever had. So I was, I had died, and I was in a sort of in a beautiful, like old world European hotel. And I was waiting to go to heaven, and I was at sort of the front desk. And in the middle of the hotel, the tree of life was growing up through the center of the hotel and out to the roof. And I asked the desk clerk if I could call my dad because I wanted to have lunch with him one more time before I had to go off to heaven. And I called him, and he said, yeah, sure, I'll meet you. And he came and he met me. And the desk clerk gave me the directions back to the hotel. He said, you have to follow these directions to the letter or you won't get back here. So my dad and I went in a dream, had lunch, and then we were driving back, and we started getting lost. And we couldn't find the hotel, and we ended up at this small, broken-down motel that was sort of like a purgatory. And the people inside were wailing, and they were desperate to get out, and they couldn't find their way back either. And I looked at the little piece of paper that the desk clerk had given me, and then I started looking at all the street signs, and all the street signs were permutations of the divine name. And I had kept misreading this. I kept misreading it because I couldn't tell the difference between the different permutations to the letter of the directions to get back. And that was how the dream ended, was understanding that this had been my great confusion and why I kept missing the mark, you know, why I kept ultimately sort of failing at having the experience that I had all my life had so sort of desperately desired, you know.
Amazing.
And so that confusion, again, about the divine will and my own will at trying so hard to massage or manipulate what I wanted the experience to be. It wasn't until I let go, and part of that was letting go of the drugs, to finally come to allow something to come to me that has proved to be much very authentic in some different ways, you know.
Does that involve kind of the embrace of the mundane? I mean, that's part of the issue, is it's not just giving up control over, you know, we want a certain kind of experience out of life. We want, you know, whatever, tremendous love or spiritual awakening or great pleasure or whatever. And then we kind of realize that those things are just kind of traps that get us into the seeking mode. And then we kind of, you know, we find another way maybe towards some kind of authenticity. But there is still that issue of, like, you know, it's one thing to, like, just embrace the ordinary day when you're just, you know, sipping your coffee and then your cute kid comes in and whatever. But it's another thing when you're just like, man, this is a mundane, dusty drag. And it's like, how to, like, not try to budge from there, you know, which is what drugs or you know, hedonism is all about. Like, okay, let's make this place more fun right now. And how have you come to that? How have you, like, because you clearly have that drive, and you're still, like your book, you're still working with that drive towards magic or towards transcendence or towards God. And yet at the same time, you can tell there's this wiser, sort of more careful, more balanced kind of voice that's in there as well. So, I mean, how have you come towards reconciling or transforming that really intense drive towards mystery that you clearly have?
I think part of it has been learning how to wait, because eventually when you're ready to receive them, those things will come to you, and they still happen through the mundane, through death, through a birth, through some experience where you might not have that think something's going to happen, but it does. And so it's about sort of being patient in the in-between times when there isn't anything going on. And then before you know it, I was watching my mother die in the arms of my father, and I had my first true spiritual experience in sobriety, you know, where I felt the roof actually being torn off the house and thunder and lightning, and, you know, God descended and something happened in that moment. And then some time later, waiting and trying to be patient with those things, my son was born, and being in the room, and it was as if it was the same moment. I heard the same sounds. I felt the same things. Something was being transformed before my very eyes, and I was completely powerless except to stand there and withstand it, you know, to sort of be there in front of Leviathan and just have to witness it. And I wasn't making anything happen, you know. And, mm-hmm. And so in those, and I think it's, you don't, that you may not get a lot of those in your lifetime, probably, you know, but the funny thing
is, to take it to the meta again, is that that is happening to someone somewhere on the earth at like every second.
Exactly.
You know?
Exactly. Yeah, that's an amazing thought.
And yeah, that's a powerful one.
Yeah. And so forget that, right?
Right. I mean, for you, the in-between times are mundane until you get to that moment. But the truth of the matter is you can participate with everyone else experiencing those as well.
Exactly.
Yeah.
that's very good. Yeah.
Well, so I'm curious. So from that perspective then, and then again we turn towards the end of the book, in the way in which you still value and understand the attempt, sometimes very focused, sometimes a little more sloppy, to use psychedelics as a vehicle towards spirituality. You look at the history of the studies. You know, there's the famous, more recent Roland Griffith study on psilocybin facilitating mystical experience for people who are properly kind of in the mind frame where there might be something that happens to them, and you're interested still in psychedelic music as a way of kind of expressing some of this stuff. So even from your newfound kind of sober mysticism and being able to recognize the traps along the way, and especially the trap of the kind of imagination that's always calling you to do, you know, experience more and farther and more intense and more pure or whatever. But how do you still see the legitimacy or authenticity of that kind of psychedelic spirituality?
I see it as authentic until it becomes the, well, again, this is always going to sound like a judgment, right? And I don't mean to, but I mean, all I'm saying is, from what I read and the people that I've talked to, that the authenticity lies in its expression as a means to begin something rather than the method to get to the end of it, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's about, for me, even though it ultimately failed, it still provided me with an essential window into understanding that, one, my consciousness is capable of much more than I thought, that, two, that there is definitely truths on the edge of things, on the fringe of things, outside the norm, that are valuable and that we should seek those things, and that there is the possibility of experiencing transcendence. But where I become skeptical is when the psychedelic itself becomes the only method by which those things are sought, again, rather than a tool to capture a glimpse of what's possible. And that's not to say that people don't have them. I'm just that's that's from what I, you know, what I'm seeing now. And part of it is the way in which those experiences become literalized and become, and people, I just do not trust the idea that any transcendent experience, be it with drugs or without, can tell us something about the actual shape of the universe, you know. And so that's where I start to sort of back away and turn to another, turn another direction to see what else somebody else has to say about it. It's sort of, it, whether I'm talking to, it's the same thing if I'm talking to a Christian and then they want to talk in such a way that to me feels, again, too literal. It's not that I don't respect that they have that belief. It just, for me, it doesn't speak to that, that other thing inside of me that balks at any kind of literalism. And so when discussions about psychedelic experiences have a sort of literal quality to them, I become bored, you know, and turn away. So
do you think that's because you have a separation between the spiritual and the mundane? Like, I'm just trying to figure out, is the literal nature of it because they're trying to relate something to a physical, like scientific structure, or what is it about that that bothers you, do you think?
Well, again, I mean, I think that, you know, so, well, part of it has to do with just what I understand for myself about how we can talk about transcendence. I was thinking a lot about the physicist David Bohm, who's very interested in all this. And one of the things he said is, you know, when just thinking about quantum physics, when we make a discovery and then we realize that that discovery we thought was the depth, but it was really just the ripples on the surface of the water.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have another discovery and then we think that that's actually now we've reached below the surface, we've reached the depth, but that's actually just another set of ripples on the surface. You know?
So you think the literality is just limiting then?
It's very limiting.
Yeah.
And so for me, the grand mystery is that we can't say anything about it except that we can't say anything about it. And so we struggle and we have words and we create mythologies and we have rituals and we have all these very complex systems of correspondences and all these other ways of trying to describe the things indescribable. And we should keep doing that. I think the stories of these things are, that we have to keep telling these stories about these experiences. But those stories don't actually say anything about the transcendent thing itself.
Well, what I like about that approach is that it kind of brings us back around to one of the things we started off with, was just talking about the role of culture. And it's also the way you kind of end the book in a way that I found very satisfying, actually, was, you know, you can sort of, you know, take the position you just did and sort of mean, you know, we must continue with our kind of religious practice, even though we know it's ultimately kind of provisional and that if we literalize it, we're getting stuck in a kind of trap with all sorts of moral and political implications, et cetera. But it's not even just about religion at that point. Then it's about cultural production, about creativity. And that story, those stories that we keep telling, they're not just in religion, they're also in, you know, in music and in stories and in fiction, in philosophy, and, you know, all sorts of productions that we do. So it gives culture this sort of flavor again, and it's almost like a way of reframing culture in a way that brings back some of that enchantment that it had for us and a lot of people, especially when you're younger, when a book or a song or a video or whatever can kind of like operate as an opening into another world, and that world that it brings you into is not the world that you might have thought you were going into, that world of realized imagination or, you know, finally getting it, but it's just the world as a constant creation, as an opening towards these possibilities. And
absolutely, and we should keep doing that, and that's why I would much rather listen to psychedelic music than to, say, read trip reports, right? That's where I can find a measure of not only truthfulness for myself, because it's a truthfulness that is trying to it knows by its very doing that it's trying to capture something that's elusive, but it does it anyways because it has to.
Yeah, and it also has to do with how the body moves through all of these things. Like, you know, a lot of that story of wanting to get to the next point or really get to the true secret or find the right name of God, like a lot of that has this real mental kind of quality, but all along your body's sitting there having all these experiences, all these emotions, all these atmospheres, these flavors, these sensations, these scents, and you know, one of the things, especially about music, is that, you know, yeah, so maybe the guy making this record was high, and maybe he wasn't high.
Exactly.
Maybe he's pretending to be high. But exactly. My body right now is going, whoa, that's weird, or wow, it's the great void of the ohm at the heart of the universe, or whatever the sort of, like, really basic level is of response. And that's
okay.
Clearly its own authenticity, even if it's made up with some pop record that some guy's just making for the heck of it, and, you know, it doesn't matter almost.
That's fine. There's nothing wrong with artifice. We need it. We need it to tell the stories. We need language, and we shouldn't distrust it for that reason, right?
Have you ever thought of making music yourself from this space?
You know, I've been sort of tinkering around with making little electronic, circuit bending stuff, and I have a little workshop in my basement I've been trying to play with doing that kind of thing. The new sort of electronic music that, like Emeralds and bands like that, are just doing some amazing things, and I think are really tapping into, you know, some of these ideas, and their music doesn't have lyrics either, right? It's all about creating these spaces.
But it's interesting is that we're all still in the analog world here, which is, you know, part of what our generation is. It's the analog sunset. And,
right.
You know, and so that space, even the fact you still be attracted to that, it's still a very 70s thing. You know, that mixture of like weird electronics and kind of spaciness. And it's like you found another way into going back, but going back in a way that's appropriate for where you are now rather than some kind of like empty nostalgia. So I hope you keep doing that, you know, making music. But we got to wrap up here, so I just
thank
want
you
to let
both
people...
so much. This was really, really terrific.
Thank
yeah,
you.
Yeah, yeah. And definitely check out the book, Too Much to Dream, The Psychedelic American Boyhood. This is Eric Davis with Maja Dao, reminding you to keep your minds open.